Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1004. I've been having an amazing time in Nashville, which is where I am right now when I'm recording this. You don't care about that, though, where I record intros and outros. But Nashville's an amazing town. I will be in Salt Lake City next week at Wise Guys Comedy Club. So if you go to ID10T.com, you can get tickets and info for that. Oh my God, you can hear how husky my voice is. I know when I've been I've been doing songs in the shows, and it's fun, but it thrashes the vocal cords. But then I can sound like this. So I guess that's a plus. Let's talk about the Community Corkboard right now for ID10T. Folk, events at ID10T.com is how you submit for that. Like Harold, who writes, after successfully funding a Pull Your Card music trivia, a hip-hop edition on Kickstarter, Pull Your Card is about to release our first expansion pack, the 90s hip-hop expansion. Pull Your Card is a multiple-choice trivia card game that includes skip, reverse, and pick any player cards that can be found on Amazon by searching Pull Your Card or Hip-Hop Trivia, or just go directly to pullyourcardtrivia.com. Valerie writes, I've been listening to the podcast forever. Thank you. And I thought this would be a great place to let everyone know about my audiobook, Chainsaw Honeymoon. I worked with author Steven Ramirez to bring this young adult story to life. Ruby, a bright, funny 14-year-old who loves shoes and horror movies, is on an insane mission to get her parents back together. But she can't do it alone. She needs her two best friends, her dog, an arrogant filmmaker, a bizarre collection of actors, and a chainsaw-wielding movie killer. What could possibly go wrong? This YA comedy horror audiobook was a lot of fun to produce, and I hope those in the community love it as much as I do. You can find the audiobook on Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Links are also on the website, valerievoiceover.com. Contact information is also there if you'd like to work on a voiceover project together, she says. All right. Nicely done, Valerie. This episode is my friend Dave Yaroveski, who directed Brightburn, which you should absolutely go see. I don't know if you remember this or not. Dave was on the podcast a handful of years ago because he also directed a movie called The Hive, which was a great indie horror movie. And Dave is a great guy. He's a dear friend of mine. And I just think he has such an amazing, fresh voice in horror, and especially with this film, which is sort of like horror superhero genres mashed together. And so support indie filmmakers, I say, in a sea of giant budget stuff. Like, make some room for the indie guys. So it was really great to have Dave back on. It's been so fun to see, you know, what he's done the last few years since The Hive, and I'm just super proud of him. So I now introduce you to episode number 1004, Dave Yaroveski, a.k.a. Yarvo, back on the ID10T podcast to talk horror. Let's roll it.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
What was the horror podcast? Did you do the Boo Crew?
Boo Crew. That's
those guys are great.
Those guys are great.
And Trevor's house is insane.
Yeah. It kind of the similar vibe where it's like this like little hidden room.
Yeah, but Trevor's like they've gone
crazy.
So into much cooler zone than here. I mean, here it's like, I don't know, that secret bookcase back into the studio.
Yeah.
And then, but his attention to detail too, because he basically has all these incredible portraits in that studio, but they're, I don't know if he explained it to you, but they're actually sound absorbers.
Yes.
So he found a way to like print really cool portraits onto absorption material.
Foam or something.
Yeah. And so it's like everything is not only aesthetically cool, but it's really functional too.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
I didn't do that. I didn't go that far. I just put the panels on the ceiling there.
Yeah. Yeah, but you have your own vibe, but just it does feel like a little bit of a secret room.
It is
a little
den. This room didn't exist. This room was just walled up.
Oh yeah, I see that. Yeah. It's concrete.
And, yeah, it's concrete. And so I had it dug out and now it's the podcast room. I think a podcast should feel like a stylish bomb shelter.
Yeah, I was gonna say in case of nuclear war.
Well, you don't know. I could come in here and podcast, you know, during the nuclear fallout.
Yeah. My plan was always if like nuclear war were to break out that I'd drive to James's house and go into his cigar cave. So this place is closer. So
it's a little bit closer than having it all the way out there. Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. Have we begun?
Yeah, we're already recording.
Good.
I love that the studio sent me this great Brightburn mask.
Yeah.
And it's actually a great, it's a well-crafted.
Yeah.
It's a well-crafted mask.
Autumn made that by hand. Actually, it's
she did?
Yeah. It's funny how it works. Autumn, my wife, designed the costume for the movie, and then the studio came to her, which to their credit, because they could have just like shopped it out to like, you know, some factory that didn't care to just make a bunch and pump them out. But they went to her first and she said, I want to do them because I want them to look cool. And so she made them. She made them in my dining room. I've been watching her make them. And then they sent it to you, which is really cool that here, how full circle we've come.
Did a top-notch job. I should probably post the picture then of, because I didn't know how else to make my eyes red. So I put strawberry Kit Kats in the eye holes to make my eyes look red. But it didn't really,
yeah,
it didn't quite capture.
Not as scary.
No, especially because you can see the Kit Kat logos.
Yeah.
And the Kit Kat logos on the package just make my eyes kind of look like derpy cartoon eyes. And so it didn't really have the effect of being a murderous alien child that I had hoped that it would have. So yeah. I'm going to figure out some other sort of appliance for the eyes. Maybe like red film or something in there so that I can still see through them. But it kind of like gives the impression that...
To be honest, you know, there's only red eyes in certain moments. So being just totally dark there also works.
Yeah, but it's...
The red eyes is just a hard thing
to not want.
You need them, yeah.
I mean, for people who are real nerds about the podcast, you came on when you did The Hive.
Yes.
Which is such a great movie.
Thanks.
And
thank you.
As someone... And I'm going to pick your brain a lot because as someone who... might try to make a horror movie. Mm. I just need to know because I think one of the things that you're so amazing at doing is you're great at working with effects on a budget.
Yes,
of being able to make effects look really cool without having, you know, $150 million to do that. So it's like your films are able to feel. The stories feel intimate, but the movies feel a lot bigger than what your budget should allow you to do.
It's a big illusion. Yeah, it's a big illusion.
But you directed commercials for a long time.
I directed music videos. I learned a lot. Music videos is what really taught me how to like spend nothing and make it look bigger because we always had nothing, you know? And they would come to me and they'd be like, hey, we've got 10 grand. Will you make a video for us? And I wasn't doing anything, and I needed to learn, and so I was like, "Yeah, but that's nothing, you know." And so, for someone who's young and hungry and trying to learn the craft of filmmaking, it's an opportunity, you know. It's a budget of something, and so figuring out how to be smart with money and use it responsibly. Now, the truth is that while I have developed, I guess, an ability to make things look like more money than they are, or to, like, I guess, do effects on a budget. I hope to, you know,
not have to do that forever
and hope to one day have a big budget and use different skills that I have. But yes, it has gotten me this far.
Well, too much money can also be a bit of a curse, because then when you can throw money at a problem, then you tend to not, when you're able to have convenience, sometimes it can fuck you over because you're not forced to be as creative as you normally can be. And that's why, you know, when James Gunn made the jump from small movies to Guardians, it was such a feat, because not everyone can go from making smaller movies and make a big movie that still has a nice intimate story but looks stunning at the same time.
Right.
That is a completely separate skill set, and it's not one that everyone has, because when you get a lot of money, I would imagine, it's like, oh yeah, well, we'll just throw a budget at it. It's like, well, that doesn't fix every problem. You still have to be creative and still have to tell a good story.
Yeah, budget can't fix a script. That's it. You know, it just can't. But it's true. What you're saying is exactly true, right? So, like, when you start out on your path to become a filmmaker, you start as an indie guy, and at least I did, and a lot of people I know did. You start and you get very tiny amounts of money, and so the skill set you develop is essentially like a skill, like, you know, I'd get, like I said, $10,000 to make a music video, or 20 or whatever, it doesn't matter, $50,000 make a video. I'm handed that money, and then suddenly I'm a producer. I'm a line producer. If I had to, you know, sometimes I'd be a first AD because, you know, I want that money on the screen. Mm-hmm. So I'm my own first AD. I would edit the thing. You know, like, I'm wearing so many hats that it's less about me being a creative and really making big, like, filmmaker creative choices. It's more about, like, surviving, getting to the end, and having something to show for it, mm-hmm. you know? And so you develop all these skills along the way, but all of them are like to help you make something at that budget. But then, you know, on a movie like this, where suddenly I have a team of people around me, I have a first AD, I have a you know, a VFX supervisor, I have a producer, a line producer, production coordinator, all those things. Suddenly, none of those skills that I've developed as an indie filmmaker are that useful, because I'm now, my sole responsibility is to be a creative, and to be, you know, and certainly I'll still use my mind, like, you know, the things I've learned in terms of being smart about how to spend money in places. But in general, all those skills are now useless, because I've kind of leveled up, and it's like, now I have to learn a whole new set of skills. How do I sell my vision to 30 different departments at the same time and make sure they're all working harmoniously, you know, while the producers and the financiers are all, you know, how do I line up all of those pieces to be harmoniously working together? And
yeah, because I'd imagine you also have to be, not only do you have to hire people that you think share your vision, but that will also do their job.
Yes.
But you also have to be a good communicator yourself, because you might get something back that someone in a department did, and I would imagine you're like, why did you think this was what you were supposed to do?
Yes, that happens more than you would think.
Why didn't you finish this when you knew, you know, it's like, how
did this get twisted?
Yeah, because I imagine you have to, like, there's that managerial part that you probably don't think of when you're young and hungry and you just want to be a creative, and you're like, oh, you have to be an effective manager at the same time, which is not something that most creatives ever want to have to do.
Yes, and at times you see a mistake happened and you realize every step that led to it. You see someone show up on set with, a shark costume or something, and you're like, how the fuck did you, okay, I don't know if I can hear this. Why did you bring a shark costume? And then you're like, oh, I said that thing about the shark, oh, like, you know, you track it back to that one sentence you said to that one person.
Hey, sharks are funny. He wants sharks.
Yeah.
And then someone, you know, you can almost get fucked over by good intentions, I think, where people hear something like, oh, sharks are really cool, even though it wasn't related to this thing, and then they get that in their mind. And they're like, oh, I thought you wanted sharks, so I told everyone they had to bring in sharks. And you're like, oh, no, thank you, but that didn't really, you
know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. And the first time, you know, the first time you're a filmmaker who's on this level, like, before, I would be a filmmaker and everyone would be like, oh, great, good luck, kid. But on this, you know, I kind of elevated a little bit and I was the director. And so, one of the things you forget is as the director, you're the director and mm-hmm. people are afraid of you and they're very sensitive to your comments and stuff like that. And they want you to be happy. And so they intensely want you to be happy. So, for example, someone came in and showed me something that was like very dark. And my reaction to things that are like dark and fucked up is that I laugh first because mm-hmm. Because this is a dark, fucked up movie, and I can curse, right?
Yeah.
It's a dark, fucked up movie, and so they put this thing in front of me, and I start laughing, and instantly I just saw that they were, like, mortified, and I was like, no, my laughter is good, like, that's so fucked up, it's so dark. But I saw in one moment, like, how sensitive, and I learned in that moment that, like, that people are taking my opinion much more seriously than they ever had before.
And you don't think of you as any different than when you're hanging out with your friends.
Yes, exactly.
But
right.
But you in the sort of, I guess we'll call it an org chart. If you're the top of the org chart, yeah. Then the way that other people see you is like their jobs depend on you being happy. So, you know, even though you never said your job depends on me being happy, people just, so I imagine that you would have to work to establish like almost a dialect with your crew. Like this means this, this means this. If I say this, this means this. If you say this, this means, just so that everyone understands each other.
Yeah. Well, listen, it was a couple things. First of all, I wanted to establish with them that like I wasn't going to be a dickhead. You know what I mean? Like talk to me. Tell me if something doesn't work. I wanted to create a safe environment for people to have a conversation with me and not feel like I was going to be upset with them or not like things. I wanted to cultivate a culture of safe openness that people could say, hey, I don't think this is going to work mm-hmm. and feel okay saying that to me. That's number one. And number two, the other, another thing that I could really see happening was, someone will come to me and they'll go, hey, what color do you want this car to be? And they lay out all these colors and they show me the car that it's going to be. And I'd be like, well, this would be consistent with our color palette and this and this and this. And they're like, great, great, great. And they go off and they, I guess they have conversations with the line producer and everyone else. And it comes back to me and it's like, why do you want to spend $150,000 painting all these cars this color? And I was like, what? No. Okay. I see what's happened here. No. Okay. They presented me a bunch of options for colors. I didn't feel that strongly in any way, but if I could pick any of them, it was that one. So they just wanted to make me happy, give me the right color. And they're like, Dave wants to paint the cars. So being sensitive to that and coming to see how it's just becoming more and more and more articulate with the way I communicate with
people. Gosh, and how many productions have been wrecked by good intentions, I wonder, where people are really just trying to do their job and they don't. It's like, almost like I imagine writing a program. If you don't put the specific language in there, then the program doesn't know. So if it's like,
that's what it's like.
It didn't occur to you to say like, hey, this isn't the most important thing. If this is in the budget and we can get this color, then this is great. But if it's too much money, it's like you wouldn't have known to give them the parameters.
Yes.
Until it came back like almost as a disaster.
Exactly right. It is a bit like programming. Yeah, yes, exactly. So I learned to say, okay, this isn't that important to me, so I wouldn't spend a ton of money on this aspect of it because it's going to be only a small piece of this one shot, but if we can pick this, just learning those things. I mean, this is like super in the weed sausage making, but these are the kind of things that when you take a step up and start making your first movie. This wasn't with a studio, it was an independent movie, but it did function a bit more like a studio movie. So when you make that first step up, these are the weird pitfalls you might find yourself stepping in.
But that's the only way to do it is to learn. And I would imagine for anyone who is listening who's like, how do I start? What do I do? It's like, well, just direct literally everything you can get your hands on.
Yes. Don't say no.
And that's going to be for no money for a while.
Yeah.
But you need those skill sets because you don't want – it doesn't do anyone any good to get into a position – that they're not ready for yet with too much money or too much anything. Like, you need to understand it first before, you wouldn't want your first job to be like a $200 million.
No. No. I would pass on a movie that size right now. My first movie was the first time I almost made a movie was in 2004. And it was this movie that, you know, I had written and I thought like was going to go. And when it didn't, I was just devastated. And when I look back, I am so happy that that movie did not go, because I was not ready to make that movie. I had shot film twice in my life. I spent probably 3 days shooting film on Super 16. And I did not have the skills and the mindset and I just was not prepared. You know, it took 10 more years for me to get The Hive. And when I made The Hive, I was ready for The Hive, but it still was a big learning.
10 more years.
Yeah.
It's so great. Like nothing is, you know, anything that's worth doing takes time. It just takes time.
It's a long journey. You learn a lot. And I'm stubborn as hell, and so it takes me twice as long to learn things. But yeah, man, it's a long journey, and it's not uncommon. Like it's common for directors about my age to start becoming, you know, a director, and you know, it's not like they just hatch at my age. It's like they spent 20 years, like, in the shit, you know.
And James's brothers wrote this, correct?
Yes.
And this is one of those pitches that when you hear it, you go, "Oh my god, why didn't someone do this before?" I mean, it's the perfect crossroads between two genres.
Yeah.
Where you're like, "Oh, it's a superhero movie, but it's a horror movie."
Yes.
Like, what a great thing. And also, I think we are at a point in our evolution of understanding superhero movies,
yes,
that we were ready for this to take the next step. It's sort of like how Deadpool couldn't have been Deadpool 10 years ago because we needed like 10 years of or years of being conditioned to understand what a superhero movie is before one could come along and like smash it.
Yes.
Smash the mold. And it's the same kind of thing.
100%. This is actually the first conversation or press or anything I've done since the movie's come out.
Oh,
and
wow.
So this is the first time I actually can talk in a way, you know, because before the movie comes out, you don't want to spoil anything, right?
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's this cool mashup, right? And it's like taking things you like about horror movies and superhero movies and putting them in one movie, and it's interesting because the first movie I watched to prepare for this was Unbreakable, because I love Unbreakables, mm-hmm. and Unbreakable was a movie that I remember going to the theater and seeing with some friends, and people coming out of it were like, "I hated that movie because of this or this or this." And I was like, "That movie's a masterpiece. I love that movie," you know? And then we, during the process of making this movie and testing this movie, we started showing it, and people came out with pretty strong feelings. Like, you know, some people come out and they really, really, really like the movie, and some people come out and they're like, and it was this weird moment where I was like, wow, we did many of the same things that happened with Unbreakable, where you like merge genres,
mm-hmm.
and people have all these different expectations on what they want to see from superhero, from horror, how much horror they want, how much superhero they want, how much it's this very interesting thing. And I didn't expect it to be as different. People really reacted to the movie like, wow, that was really different. That was really unique. And I, to me, it felt very straightforward. We're going to tell this very simple superhero story, and it was going to devolve into a fucking nightmare slasher movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the wheels would come off. But people reacted like this was a very different, movie, which was neat.
And it also shows you the power of expectations going into something, because if people, and that's why like the way that something is marketed is so important, because there's so many, it's like the movie Edge of Tomorrow is a fucking great movie.
Yes.
And it got marketed in a weird way, so I think people didn't really know what to expect, or they thought like, oh, it's some other weird futuristic Tom Cruise movie. And then you go see it, and you're like, oh, it's like sci-fi Groundhog Day.
Oh, it's the best.
But it's great.
Yeah.
But it didn't – I think it didn't maybe do as well, because I think people's expectations – it's sort of like when you take a sip of a drink, and you're like, oh, I'm going to have a sip of this Coca-Cola, and it turns out to be water, and you're like, yeah. What is this? Yeah. You're like, well, it's just water. If you knew it was water, you would have liked it.
Exactly.
But because you thought it was going to be Coke, it like your brain got twisted.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember the first time we did the first test screening. And there was a couple people in the front row who were you ask them questions after the movie and stuff, and they were like, oh, I was kind of expecting like big like Avengers-y action explosion chaos, and I was like, oh yeah, no we're a very small little horror movie, but I remember thinking that and just seeing the diversity of like expectations and how people process the movie. It was really interesting.
Did that change? Because every time you make something, I feel like the learning curve is so substantial. So did that process of talking to people afterwards and going like, oh, that's what you thought? Like, how does that change the next thing you do?
Yeah, I think you always learn so much. Like, man, I feel like over the course, you know, it's been a 2-year journey for me. And over the course of 2 years, I feel like I've learned so much. I mean, especially working with James, who's a genius, and working so closely with him and hearing the way he processes things and going through it. Like, man, I feel like I just absorbed a 1,000 books worth of information. It's crazy. And I talked to him, and he says he feels that way after every movie he makes, which is crazy because he's made so many movies, so many big movies. But yeah, I think you're always learning. You're always seeing like new things. Through James, I learned new dimensions of preparation that I didn't even know were possible, if that makes any sense. Like new, you know, I came into this insanely prepared, or at least way more prepared than I had ever been, and more prepared than crew members were used to directors being, but less prepared than James, because he would be like, well, what about this? What happened? You know, and he kind of opened up avenues for me to be like, oh, oh yeah.
Yeah. I've already started picking his brain about directing stuff.
Yeah.
He's
very good.
I know, but I wasn't prepared one day. I called him to just say like, hey, you know, sometime when you have time, I just love to pick your brain about directing. He was like, how about now? And I'm like, so what do you do? Where did the camera go? You know, yeah. Like, but he had such great information. But again, it's one of those things, no matter how many, it's great that people tell you stuff, but it just, I imagine it's just like stand up or performing music or whatever. It's like you just have to do it to learn stuff. No one can prepare you with words.
No. Because what happens is you get on set and you think something's going to go this way, and then it doesn't. You know, you think the scene's going to work. You've been planning the scene for a year, and you get to the set and you set up the camera and you look at it and you watch the scene and you're like, oh, this looks like shit. Now what? You know, now you're a fucking director, because the entire time you've just been a guy in a room making plans, but all of a sudden you're sitting there and you have, you know, rows of producers watching the monitor going, I don't know about this. You know,
it's gonna be fine, everyone. It's gonna be fine.
Yeah, and that's when you become a director. Is the things you do in that moment to navigate the ship through the shaky waters.
But isn't that, I feel like that people can apply that to anything, which is no matter how, you can only prepare so much, but your openness to flexibility, I think, is one of the most important skills to cultivate.
Yeah.
Because most things, you know, I mean, I guess I sort of think of it like archery.
Yeah.
How many times are you going to hit the bullseye? You know, it's like, or golf. Like, how many hole-in-ones are you ever going to get? Probably zero. So it's just proximity. Like, how close can you get to your idea, and how flexible and how improvisational can you be within that structure? I feel like that's probably the most important skill set.
Sure. Well, I think as your budget grows, the need for versatility shrinks because you have more and more time to pull things off. But for me, I like to go in. I know every scene in the back of my mind, I know what scenes could potentially be cut from the movie, could not make the movie, you know, if worse comes to worse. I know the easiest path through scenes before we start shooting him. Like, for example, what that means is, you know, sometimes you'll go to a scene and you're like, to get out of the scene, to finish this scene, to move on to the next thing, I owe 10 or 15 shots. But I, for every scene I do, I have a plan to get out of a scene in a shot or two. I know how to solve those things so that when I need to, hopefully I don't have to. But those are kind of the dimensions of planning I'm talking about. It's like understanding 4D chess, especially when you're making a horror movie.
Understanding 4D chess. That's a great way to put it.
It is because you're making a horror movie, right? And so it's in a way, it's like a comedy where you're like, okay, we're going to do this scare. We're like setting everything up for this scare to happen. And then you get there on the day and it looks dumb as hell. It doesn't, you know, that's what happens. And so you're like, okay. A prepared director in this moment has three other options for how the scare could play out, how the jump can happen. Pan over, see it. Snap up, see it. He jumps out of here. Like, different ways to do this scare. And then also, at the same time, ways to get around the scare entirely if you have to. Like, just set it up and let it be tense. But knowing that, like, you're going to pick up these pieces that you're going to bring with you back and work with an editor and make that scene work. But just, and part of the experience of making movies, you start to know what's a dangerous thing you're going to do. What has a possibility for total failure and what might be okay. But yeah, you start to read a script. Now I read a script and I'm like, the stupidest things you would never think about, I'm like, that will be a nightmare. Mm-hmm. That moment right there will be a total fucking nightmare. No one can see it coming, and it'll be a disaster on the day, and everyone will freak. You know, you could just see those things coming now.
Well, and do you think horror is in a good state right now? I tend to wonder. I mean, like, there's just so much of it in all directions. But in general, do you think, like, it's in a good place?
Well, I think it's in a good place because for a long time, you know, I don't know why I always relate this to this. Like, what's that band? OK Go. Mm-hmm. In a way, OK Go kind of slit my career's throat. In a way, but they didn't really mean to. But they made that first music video that broke out for them for like $100 or something like that. I remember $200. You know, the guys running on the treadmills. Yes. And so I get into music videos, and I'm starting to get slightly bigger budgets, and then they make that video. And then, and at the same time, the music, I'm going somewhere, but this will get to
I see where
you see where I'm headed. Yeah. So suddenly every meeting I'm in, they're like, so how can we make a video
for $200?
They did it. And I'm like, I don't know, but I'm not going to be the guy to make you a video for $200.
Yeah.
And so suddenly, like, that was the first really domino, but all of a sudden people started imagining, what happens if we don't spend $500,000 on a music video? What happens if we spend $50,000 on a music video?
Well, because these musicians were going bankrupt.
Yes.
Because, you know, in the 90s where you have that sort of rise of, like, the Mark Romanek videos, mm-hmm. which are stunning, mm-hmm. but also really expensive. And it's like, well, the artists who, like, their labels were getting pretty much all their money, and they were getting expense for all that stuff. It's like they couldn't recoup that money.
Yep.
So it, like, the idea of it's really amazing. Oh, we're going to – and then you also have the sort of, you know, before the rise of Vevo, you have, like, no one's watching music videos anymore.
Yes.
You know, now people, like, you can rack up quite a few views on Vevo and so, but
kind of, but they're not, it's not the same value.
But it's not quite, it doesn't it's not quite what it have was. The same. Yeah. And so, yeah, I can, it's like there's like 10 things going on that I would imagine that make people go, like, can you do this for $200?
Exactly. So cut to a few years later, I made some music videos. Finally, I'm in a place where I start meeting with studios and they're like, so there's this movie, Paranormal Activity. and they made it for nothing. So can you make a horror movie for nothing?
You can never forget it's a business.
Yeah,
never.
And I'm like, oh, fuck. And so I would go. So all of a sudden I started to see horror movies. And every place I would go, they're like, okay, so what we decided to do was we're going to spend $2 million this year and we're going to produce 18 horror movies with that $2 million,
and they're just hoping one of them makes like $50 million to $100 million.
Yes, exactly. And so that became the thing for a while. And so every movie you saw was a couple people stuck in a house, nothing happened till the very end, and you just saw over and over and over again because no one had any money, you know. And then suddenly I really think it was like Stranger Things that really broke it, but like all of a sudden people started like spending money on horror. Horror movies started like like they were just making tons of money. One of the first weeks we started working on this movie, like in early pre-production, there was an article that came out that was like, you know, 50, 60, 70, $80 million movies were moving off their date because a $10 million, $15 million horror movie was getting placed on that date and they were scared of them. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, you know, people started spending money on horror movies. And as a result, you're seeing cool things. You're seeing like things that you could never afford to do before. You know, you could never have made A Quiet Place before. This new like reinvestment in money in horror movies.
That's really interesting to hear, because it does make sense that bigger studios would be afraid of a $10 or $15 million or even a $5 million movie, because the thing about horror, I think, is that it almost, the right horror movie almost has no competition. Obviously you wouldn't want to release a movie opposite Avengers, but for the most part,
we did.
Not the same weekend.
Yeah,
though.
Not the same weekend though. Yeah,
but I mean, like, you pretty much, horror movies don't have the same competition, I think, that other movies have, because it's such a specific audience.
Yeah,
and even if like the core group of horror fans come out, it can be successful, and then if it tips and becomes mainstream, then it's like, then it gets crazy.
Yeah,
but it. But I also feel like the downside is what you said, which is companies go, we're going to make 18 movies, you know, for, you know, yeah, $50,000 each.
Yeah.
And then you start that, you know, it's like, oh, well, that's why we got flooded with found footage movies, you know, because they're cheap. They're cheap to make.
They're cheap to make.
And then there's a flooding of like, okay, this horror movie is all going to take place in a video chat where everyone's on some sort of video chat.
Exactly.
And you know, that can lead to creativity, but it also just leads to a glut of like, because we, Lydia and I, watch as many things as we can, and there are so many movies. I feel like with horror, you really kind of rate them in your, and we kind of rate them on a sliding scale. It's like, you know, great concept, maybe not the best execution, couple good scares, probably needed some more of this, you know, what the fuck happened in the third act, why did it? And so I just imagine, well, you know, again, because these things are very hard to do, I applaud anyone who is actually able to make a movie and get it seen somewhere, because it's fucking hard to do.
Yeah.
But
and it makes sense.
Yeah.
If it makes sense and people see it, you deserve a little medal.
Yeah.
A little trophy.
Yeah. And I imagine that most of the things that don't make sense to you were just unforeseen issues. Like maybe there was footage that didn't turn out okay and they couldn't reshoot it.
Yeah.
Maybe someone didn't show up that day. Maybe it rained and that was the only day they could shoot outside, so they lost a whole scene and they had to do, you know, like I don't know.
Oh yeah, on The Hive I shot the climax of the movie in 2 hours. And I shot it in 2 hours, and about an hour in I looked at the DP and I was like, we're never gonna be able to shoot this with all these people here. Let's ditch him. And so me and the DP grabbed two actors and we ran away from the crew and just shot it all handheld to just get through it, because they were bogging us down. They were too slow. They couldn't keep up and we just wouldn't have had an ending to the movie.
You mean setting up all the lighting and all the everything, like the entire...
Yeah. Wait. Oh, I need to do this. Wait. I need to do that. Yeah. I'm like, okay, well, I need to have a shot.
This movie has to end.
Yeah,
have to wrap it up.
Yeah, I was doing a commentary, and I mean, this is a bit crude, but I was doing a commentary, and we were talking about advice for people making their first movie, especially if it's a $500,000 movie or a small movie like we did. And I told them that you don't get to shit when you make the movie, because you're shooting so fast that if you shit, the entire production shuts down. You lose pages. So
is that shit worth $20,000?
Yes, exactly. Is that shit worth that scene that you wrote?
Sometimes it is, though. I got to be honest. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is.
I told. So I think it's on our commentary, on our DVD commentary. But like for real, like you're shooting so quickly and so fast that, if you have to take a phone call, if your mom calls to see how you're doing, you just lost like a setup or two. You know?
You know what you should do is we should invent a, we should invent like a video village porta potty so that you can shit with the screen in there and still communicate on headsets.
Yeah.
On the, so that it, you're not losing any time.
Yeah.
That you could, you're never losing any time.
I don't think that anyone would use it.
We call it the Shittio Village. It's just like that's where you go to take your dumps, but still be able to direct a movie at the same time. Yeah. I feel like that if it, people alone would pay a couple hundred bucks for one of those to save them thousands.
Yeah, but you're targeting a group of people who have no money in the first place.
Also known as a bucket in your iPhone.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, but for real though, that is really like that is the kind of director advice that no one will ever tell you. But when you are making that first movie, you have no time. You really have zero time. So it is funny to say, but it's also pretty true. Like you cannot stop working, and so
yeah. But I think the part where I keep getting tripped up is I feel like endings, you know, because horror movies are a bit of a magic trick. Hmm. There's a reveal. And sort of like you said, you know, that swath of the low budget ones where it's like two people talking and then something crazy happens at the end. If the crazy thing that happens at the end is amazing, it works. But if the gag doesn't work, then the entire movie was a bust and a waste of time. And so it's very much like writing the end of a comedy sketch too, where you want to make sure that the story sticks the landing. And how do you keep surprising people when audiences now are just too savvy? They've seen so many things.
Yeah.
There's only so many new, you know, it's like there's only so many, it's like there's a finite number of concepts.
Totally. Yeah. There's a finite number of scares. Yeah. You're exactly right. But there's a finite number of scares. You see the same scares in every movie. And when I was doing research for the movie, I'd watch every Conjuring movie, Mama, other, I just watched every supernatural horror movie you could back to back. I had a notepad and I was just making notes on things and how things worked and the mechanics of what felt scary when and why it felt scary and what anticipation, what a shot was, when did I feel the anticipation, when didn't I, you know, just making like really detailed notes. And like you just start to see it's the same scare over and over and over and over again. It's just done in slightly different ways. You know what I mean? Like the jump scare in the Annabelle movie where she's like running towards the door and the door comes yeah. open and she, you know, she's like older, you know, and it's totally scary. You know, you've seen it 40 different ways, but it's just about how you do it and how you can kind of reinvent it. For us, it was like injecting superhero DNA into those scares. Like,
yeah.
How do you, you know, to take this gag or that gag, but like make it superhero-y.
I always feel bad when I watch a low budget horror movie, which is most of them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like the story ends and then there's one last, like a ghost or a demon Ooh. Just like runs to the screen like, yeah. and then it just credits. And I always go, aw.
Yeah.
Like it obviously their ending didn't give them the, it didn't manifest the way that they wanted. So they were like, well, I guess let's just have a demon jump at the screen. I don't know how else to, I don't know how else to finish this.
You know, it's funny. Like you'd be surprised at how much perspective you lose so quickly. Like, you know, there were like, I'll give you an example. The jump scare in the trailer where, you know, where Brandon just launches.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And like you watch like trailer reactions online and you see people like falling backwards out of their chair when it happens because the jump really got people. But the day before we released it, when I'm doing the like sound mix on the stage, I'm watching it and we're tweaking the sound and I'm like, I don't know. Is this jump working? You know, because I've seen it only 10,000 times.
Right.
You know, with different audio at different speeds, at different this, different that. And I'm like, I don't know. Doesn't feel and people in the room are like, "Yeah, it's pretty effective." And I released it going, "I hope it works." I had no idea.
That's the scary part to me. That's the real jump scare with filmmaking that I go, "How do I know?" Because you see it so many times and you lose your to see it with new eyes or to really understand and to hear like different sounds, different speeds, different this. It's like, there's a million ways to do it.
You got to just test it on people. You have to find people that you trust. You know, You know, I remember, I don't know if you like the movie Interstellar. I really like the movie Interstellar.
But, oh, yeah.
But there's a scene where Matthew McConaughey's like, time is a fleeting resource that we have now, or mm-hmm. it's a diminishing resource. And I always feel that about objectivity in directing. So I always have this moment where I'm like, okay, where I'm Matthew McConaughey in that scene where I'm just like, okay, this is my objectivity, okay? It's just diminishing every day. It's yeah. going. And we need to solve this, this, and this, and the, you know? And so that is, so the game is like trying to hold on to that and trying to show people, you know, trying to put it in front of people and get their reaction.
When we were in Europe, the last handful of days of the trip, Lydia got really sick. She'd get this infection, this like sinus throat infection. And so we were kind of bad. That's okay. We were bedridden for the last few days. We were in the UK, which is actually great.
That sounds great.
Because we had spent 2 weeks like walking 10 hours a day all over Italy. And then went to Disneyland in Paris. And so it was actually kind of nice to rest for a few days. So neither one of us had watched T2 in a while. And we watched it. And it's completely still fucking fantastic. And I had forgotten, like, oh, yeah, it's a horror movie. Like, it really is a sci-fi horror movie.
Yes.
And it was so well done that even though the effects were so cutting edge, it sort of reminded me like Ghostbusters. It's like the movie works on this one story level, but the effects for the time were groundbreaking, and the music was groundbreaking, and the same thing for T2. And it's just that feeling that you get the entire movie. It's like, oh, they never can stop. I mean, it was the same thing in the first Terminator, but
yes,
it's this thing is endlessly pursuing them, sort of like the God damn it, what's the horror movie where the girl has the STD that is a demon?
It Follows?
Yeah, the same as It Follows, where it's like...
It's an STD that's the demon.
It is.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is.
It's a... Yeah.
It's not like a quiz show, though. Like a
$25,000 pyramid.
Yeah, yeah.
STD, sexually transmitted demon. They should have called it sexually transmitted demon, first of all.
Yeah, yeah, they should have.
But it's the same kind of thing where that has an inherent horror factor in the sense that it's not stopping and starting. It's the whole time it's like something's chasing them. But what I think a lot of horror movies are not necessarily able to do, or they try to force it in, is that you know, T2 also had some heart to it, which is like, how do you start empathizing with this? I mean, the idea of it started really melting my mind. It's like, okay, they took this kind of like cult favorite movie from the early 80s, which was a great sci-fi cult horror movie, and they took the antagonist and they made him the protagonist. How the fuck did that? Like, what a genius idea. And then you empathize, and how at the end, when he's giving the thumbs up going into the fucking molten metal, where you're not like, you go, Terminator. You know, he has to sacrifice himself. And then you're like, you feel, and it really made me think like, okay, a good horror movie also has to have some heart to it. Like, it can't just be like, yeah, we're going to kill these fucking people and then this fucking sucks for them, you know? Unless it's just super grindhousey and that's the whole purpose of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope that people don't perceive this movie that way. I hope that people see the heart in it. This movie, for me, had a lot of heart in it. I was very, when I read the script that Brian Mark wrote, there was this, part of the movie where Tori, the mother, is very like, my son's special, I believe in him, and the whole world, you know, is every bit of evidence around her and the whole world is saying something's wrong with your kid, and she's defending him, and to me, I connected to that because I was a weird kid. I mean, I'm probably still a weird kid, but I mean, I was obsessed with horror movies and Freddy Krueger and making scary movies in my backyard and covering my friends in fake blood, and obviously, you know, when you're 13 and doing that, some parents might be like, why is my kid coming home covered in fake blood? That's not normal. And so my mom had to kind of go out there and be like, he's just creative. He's a good kid. And so to me, the movie really became a weird, totally fucked up, dark thank you to her in a weird way. Although obviously in the movie, the kid is not good. He's a bad dude, and But in a way, it was sort of like I was able to make this movie because someone like Tori defended me.
That's really sweet.
See, there is a little heart.
That's really sweet.
Yes.
You know, I also had a really fucked up thought, was imagining is trying to understand why parents allow their kids to dress up as Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
Because he was like this child murderer.
Yes. Son of a thousand maniacs.
Yeah,
son of a hundred maniacs.
Son of a hundred maniacs. Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. As we learned from the... Was it Dream Warriors? I think it
might have been Dream Warriors. Where did Son of a Hundred Maniacs come from? That was probably Dream Warriors.
I think it was Dream Warriors because didn't we learn that that's where Amanda Krueger... Was that her name, Amanda Krueger, the mother? She was the nun, and then all the maniacs got... Yeah, and so it...
But the thing you think about him isn't that he's... That the thing you think of with him is that he's the demon thing that haunts your dreams, and that's right. Sort of the backstory. You don't like get into that.
You don't get into the weeds on that one.
Yeah,
yeah. I hope they're if they ever reboot that again.
Okay, go on.
Is that one you think they should just leave alone?
No, that's one I would kill to remake.
Oh, that's got to be the next one. I would love to see you remake that because I feel like the last one was like. Where do you stand on... Because I feel like you're a guy... My perception of you is that you're a guy that is squarely in the middle of practical versus digital effects. It feels like you do like the tactile...
Oh, I could talk about this for real.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about
this. And the reason that I dove into this is because I feel like that reboot that they did, there was like... It was the moment where the CG, where he was pushing through the wall, I was like, oh no, that's kind of taking me out of it. And, yes. And again, I'm sure it was for budgetary reasons. Who knows? I mean, I don't know. But especially,
I have so much to say.
Especially in horror, I feel like CG, like too much CG is dangerous because it kind of spoils the effect.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you've just opened a huge case.
Please.
All right. So, okay. Where to chip away? So I've sat in a million rooms trying to get my first movie at a studio, and I've sat across from producers being like, "This is what we're gonna do. We're gonna do all these effects, but they're gonna be practical. We're gonna build everything. They're gonna be puppets. We're gonna do all this stuff, and that's how we'll save money, and that's how we'll whatever." And then on this movie, we were like, we're going to do all this stuff practical, and we're barely going to use visual effects, and we'll just pick and choose whatever. And you know, I can tell you right now that every practical gag that we had in the movie was augmented in some way with visual effects, because the nature of practical effects is, A, insanely time-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't spend a day doing this one shot, you know? Because that's, you know, I got 29 days to shoot the movie. So you don't get a day. That's number one. Number two, the ability of practical effects can only get you so far. I mean, the things you remember about practical effects are like the best moments. But there's often like another shot before it and another shot after it that isn't quite as good. And if they at the time had visual effects to help like blend or cover or hide or obfuscate, you know, the whole gag would have been better. So like, for example, you know, all of the destruction in the movie, we were shooting cannonballs through walls and blowing things up.
Oh, that's fun.
Oh my God. It was fun.
That's really fun.
But then we'd paint we had this like, you know, big cannonball thing. And then we just digitally paint Brandon in, but then we'd look at it and it was like, okay, so we have this practical wall exploding this way. But it's not destructive enough. Maybe more debris, maybe more glass, maybe more this, more that. And by the end, you know, there's certainly all the practical elements there. Then they're enhanced with visual effects. Then there's smoke added. Then we had to shoot things in separate elements. Then we had to paint Brandon in. So at the end of the day, what ended up looking by far the best was the hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a couple shots that we kind of in the editing room invented where we're like, what if Brandon just went this way and did this? And we went for it. We pulled the trigger on it. Visual effects delivered us those effects. They did a great job doing it. But every time we were there on the day planning it and we shot, you know, we shot practical elements with it and we did all the sort of planning that you need to go into those shots look night and day better. They're not even comparable.
Yeah.
So I would say that I am squarely in the camp of do everything you possibly can to have as much practical and as much like actual practical elements in the shot, and then enhance.
Do the icing. Yeah, that's what I thought what you were going to say, because that balance between the two, and it does feel like there's the foundational element of a practical effect that needs just the icing of the visual effect to sell it. Like, I don't know if you ever saw the, I don't know, maybe it was like 8 or 9 years ago, but they, you know, released the first, I feel like it was maybe just the first season, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm sure the internet will correct me on this, of the original Star Trek series. Mm. And they just enhanced some of the effects with digital, but it was so subtle but effective that, yes, they didn't try to paint over practical stuff, but it was just like screens in the background or those external shots of the Enterprise. They just enhanced a little bit, and it elevated everything. And so that, to me, but again, might be in a situation where it's like, well, we can't do the practical. It has to be all visual if we want any effect there. So what are we supposed to do?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, look, to what you're saying, right? Like every time you see a movie where you see all these like makeup effects on people where they have very heavy prosthetics, anywhere from, I don't know, a Guardians to Star Trek, like you're saying. But, you know, they have these characters, actors who are wearing these effects, and you think of those shots as practical, but they're not. Someone went in there and cleaned up the seams, because, you know, 20 years ago you'd see someone in a Star Trek movie or something, and you could see where the prosthetic ended and the
right.
face began, and
right.
it got all crusty and weird and all those spots, and you know like not much has changed in the way of prosthetics. I mean, they've gotten thinner, and they now do silicone instead of foam and stuff, but in general there's still going to be seams and there's still going to be stuff. And so using digital effects, they can just kind of clean it up. That, you know, every once in a while a prosthetic will bend somewhere or something, they can just smooth it out. Just make it a little cleaner.
Yeah, I mean, listen, people do that on their own Instagram pictures. Why can't we do it in movies?
On a screen that's going to be 80 feet tall, yeah.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is the... I wonder if it's important to know when you're making a film going into it whether or not it's going to have a theatrical release. Does that change how you do things, because you know, like, well, most people are just going to see this on a, you know,
dramatic,
a small TV set.
Yeah. Well, yeah. On when we
most horror will never see a theater.
Yeah. Yeah. When I'd make music videos, I'd watch them on my iPhone to make sure that they played well, because the sad reality is that that's where 90% of people will watch it. But yeah, no, when you're coming out in a theater, yes, you need to watch that movie on a theater. The first time we put that movie on a theater, I was shocked at how much you could see, like how much detail there was. Like, you could see everything. and yeah, it was shocking. And also, I mean, this is kind of way in the weeds, but there was, you know, you're shooting and you have a monitor, like, I don't know, 27-inch monitor or something, which is the monitor you look at, and you look at it and you're like, oh, that, okay, we set up for a wide shot, that looks plenty wide, you know, and then you get to a bigger screen and you're like, no, that's not really that wide, because
right.
on the monitor it looks like the person's, you know, an inch, but then you put it on a bigger screen or on a in the theater, and they're still a quarter of the screen, and so yeah, you kind of have to gauge what a wide is,
right?
You know, and what a tight is, because, you know, I on a music video, it would not be uncommon for me to live on like an anamorphic 150 millimeter lens, super flattering, you know, but it can be this big,
mm-hmm.
you know, and but if it's on someone's screen, it's just a flattering close up. But if it's in a movie screen, you know, it's just a face. That's all there is. It's just a 80-foot tall face. And so yeah, you really do have to kind of pick your how you're going to shoot it based on.
And I imagine also which details are going to be important. We watched a horror movie not that long ago, and the lead character was a woman who was in a mental hospital. And the thing that totally took me out of it that I started going like, I wonder, was that her decision or the director's decision or makeup decision? Is that it looked like she had like fake eyelashes, and you could see, you know, so it's like around fake eyelashes, they'll do like a line of like when people wear fake eyelashes, there's like a line, I think, of like a pencil eyeliner to sort of blend it in. And the whole time I was thinking like, where did this mental person in a mental hospital get fake eyelashes and an eye pencil? Like, and it completely, and so I went down this like, okay, so was that, was the makeup person just kind of like, oh, these will make your eyes look nice? Or was the actor like, you know, I like to have fake eyelashes? Or was the director like, oh, like, let's pop her eyelash? Like, I couldn't figure out. But I imagine, like, if you saw that on a screen, you'd be like, she's got fake eyelashes, you know, if it was like a giant, and I don't think it came out on a big screen, but it's those little details.
Man, it is those little details. and let me tell you, like, what you're saying is exactly right, and it is sort of the blessing and the curse of making these things is, you know, that director, I don't know anything about the movie you're talking about. They could have made a fucking masterpiece, and they could have made every right decision, but those eyelashes are going to bother 40% of the viewers and distract them. And so, you know, that is kind of the way the movie making process is. It's like you're constantly surprised at like all of these things work together so harmoniously and everything adds up in this cool way. And then this thing happens and people attach themselves to it.
Right.
Like, well, that sucks.
Yeah. There's a lot of things. That's the coffee cup in Game of Thrones.
There's a lot. Yeah. The coffee cup in Game of Thrones. Right? Exactly. Exactly. This cool episode or whatever, however you feel about it, in this amazing show that's been playing out across all these years. And then all anyone wants to do is talk about the coffee cup.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. 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 Exactly. But again, I think missed opportunity to make Game of Thrones the sort of the sci-fi, the Renaissance world in Westworld. Like, that could have been a great
crossover. Like, someone just steps through and
yeah,
all
at the
robots.
Very end, like, one of them just gets on that subway and leaves. And you're like, oh, fuck, the whole thing was the Westworld. You know, but yeah, I think people probably would not have been happy if that was the ending.
There would have been riots in the street.
But in my heart, that's the crossover that's happening.
Yeah, no, I think it would have been a great twist if someone just like woke up at the end, they were dead the whole time, you know?
Oh boy, people would have been so mad.
Riots.
Yeah, you can't have dream or dead anymore. Like that one's done. It's or done. I'm the ghost, you know? I'm the ghost. Worked twice. It worked on Sixth Sense and it worked on the others. And I don't think you can do I'm the ghost anymore.
Yeah.
It turns out I'm the ghost.
Yeah, like Tyrion wakes up on like a subway. He was sleeping the whole time. He's just like, oh. Yeah. What a crazy dream that
was. Yeah, and then it's just like, oh, yeah. And then you see, you know, Daenerys is like a lady who's like preparing for an audition.
Yeah, they're all on the subway together.
Yeah, and then Jon Snow is like a guy playing a guitar on the subway. And you're like, no! Oh, my God.
There would have been blood in the streets. There would have been riots.
It just seems like if you really think about all the ways that, you know, like, how could you cause like world scale riots without actually like launching a war? Like, what are the little things you could do that aren't like technically harmful, but would drive people to the edge but would drive humanity to the brink of extinction? So the future generations would be like, here's the crazy story about how humanity almost like bottlenecked and almost went under because of this Game of Thrones ending, you know? Like,
a show became so popular that the ending.
Because if you read social media, that's the fever pitch that everything is at right now, where it's like, oh, because someone didn't like an ending to a show, humans are on the brink of collapse.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Everything's on the brink of collapse if you take social media literally. Everything's on the brink of collapse.
Yes, that is true.
Well,
it's at 11. It's at 15.
So just thinking about the brink of collapse as a way to sort of wind this chat down. I would love to talk about, because you do live with something for 2 years, and then it comes out.
Yes.
And then I would imagine you have something that is akin to like a postpartum type depression with this brain baby that you have birthed that has been such a chunk of your life. Is it a relief to be done with it? Are you already thinking about what you want to do next? Are you like, I need time to process this? I need time. Like, are you in a weird depression because it's done and you can't stress about it anymore?
You know, the depression comes from a little bit, but I got it weeks ago. What happened was I worked in a room like, honestly, not much bigger than this room with mm-hmm. Simon and James. He wasn't in the room all the time because he didn't need to be. There were very non-creative decisions being made. But, you know, in a room with them and with the editor and just with a lot of people every day. Wake up, go to the office, be in this room with these people and got really close. I mean, you know, got really close with these guys. And then just not seeing them on a daily basis kind of bums me out. You know, yeah, there's I think anytime you make something, you're like, oh, okay, well, there was that, you know. I was driving with my wife to Starbucks or something like that, and I was like, hey, remember when we were working on that movie?
Just how suddenly everything just like the momentum, yeah. Just like there now it is. We're done, that's now we're it done.
But yeah, I mean, I'm someone who's happiest when I'm working. And truthfully, there are different parts of the filmmaking process that are more and less enjoyable. For me, I really like developing. I really like the pre-production. I really like shooting the movie. And I really like editing the movie. And then once it starts doing the, like, release stuff and the like, that stuff, it's the least enjoyable thing for me. Because it's just something different, you know? I don't know. I can't explain it. It doesn't feel creative. It just feels like, I don't know. I can't possibly put it to words what it feels like, but it feels like not like any of the other phases where you're just working with a small group of people in a room being creative and figuring things out.
Well, you are in a relationship with an entity. Like, the thing becomes an entity and you are in a relationship with it. And I think 2 years is like the minimum that, especially for movies, like,
oh yeah,
some people can be with stuff for 5 years, 10 years, you know, if you're James Cameron, 20 years developing technologies or whatever, you know, so it is kind of a weird, like, I almost wonder if there's like a bit of counseling that a director should go through.
It's because
you do go through a bit of a loss where it's like you put it out there. And it's a big piece of you, and all of a sudden people are scrutinizing it and judging it and looking at it, and it's not yours anymore.
I know, it's weird. You know,
how did George Lucas not go fucking insane?
How did he not go insane? You know, look, here's the thing. The Twitter didn't exist then.
It didn't, you're exactly right. You know what, I feel like you're kind of joking, but you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Because people still gave him shit. And it's like, once it's out in the world, like, it's not yours anymore.
Yeah.
That's part of the deal. If you put it out there for consumption,
it's going to be consumed.
It's going to be consumed and not yours.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, I think
share ownership.
I think I've taken a healthy approach. Like, I've never looked on Twitter about the conversation about the movie. Like, I have no idea. I didn't really read any reviews. I didn't really, like, you know, do any of that stuff because that stuff makes you crazy. And that's, you know, the weird thing about making a movie is it's never about the end of the process, you know? Like, I remember on The Hive, that night you were there when we introduced the movie in Burbank.
Yeah.
And it was like I worked that whole time. That movie was 3.5 years, you know, to get to that moment where we were showing the movie. And I worked tirelessly on it until that very end moment. Introduced the movie, watched the movie with everyone, and I was like, "Yep, there it is, hour and a half." And people were like,
"Starbucks,
yeah, let's get, yeah, exactly." And then people were like, "Oh, okay, that was that." And in that moment, I immediately realized it's never about that hour and a half. You know, it's about a life of being creative and working towards making, like, you know, a director's job is telling a story, but it's also improving the movie over and over and over again, finding ways to elevate it, make it better, and then move on to the next one. But it's really about enjoying that, mm-hmm. you know, because if it's all about the end result, you'll never be happy because the end result is an hour and a half. You show all your friends, like, I did the same thing in this. I got all my friends and family in a room. I showed them the movie in an hour and a half. It was done. This thing I've been talking about.
No, we were in Europe for that. Otherwise, I would have been there.
It was a fun night.
If you could have done it in Italy, we could have gone.
Tempting. It was tempting.
But that's the thing, is that it's because you can't – you have no control over that. You have no control over it once you put it out. It's like,
yeah.
You've done everything you can do, and then it's like, you know.
People kept asking me, are you nervous? Are you excited? And I was like, I'm – you know, I'm kind of none of those things. I'm really proud of the movie that I made and that I handed off, and then it's going to go do whatever it's going to go do. But But like I was excited to show my friends what I did, my family what I did. But somehow, the world feels like so much smaller in terms of like Twitter and all these things where things are easily connected. But at the same time, you somehow feel so detached. Like you see online people start tagging you in things and then, oh my God, there's a giant bus in Mexico City that's covered in your artwork, or there's this or here in the world. But in a way, it's just kind of pictures on social media. You're just kind of at home playing Spider-Man because all your friends played it while you were making the game and you didn't get to. You know, I spent most of this weekend playing Spider-Man. That's what I did this weekend.
Yeah, I was so excited to be in a cafe in Venice and I sent you the screenshot.
Yes.
Where it's the film in Italy translated to Angel of Evil.
I love that.
It's really fun.
I do like seeing that stuff really like makes me happy, and it makes me feel connected to this thing that is everywhere. All these people are having these experiences with the movie, and I just feel like not a part of it. I'm very happy to be not a part of it, but I mean, I don't feel like a part of it. Like I feel like it goes like it has left the nest and it's going to go live its life now. And I have video games I have to catch up on.
And another thing, are you writing anything else at the moment?
I'm always like, I've written some things, but I'm also, I'm developing this thing and I'm doing this thing. I don't really have anything that I can like talk about, but certainly this movie has opened doors for me, and hopefully I'll get to make some more cool stuff if I'm fortunate enough.
I hope so. I'm just so excited. I know how hard you've worked, and I mean you have such a great eye and a great style, and it's so exciting to. And also, you're just fucking so nice. You and Anna were just so nice.
Oh, thanks.
And Lydia and I have so enjoyed becoming friends with you the last few years.
Yeah, it's been cool.
And I'm so excited to see what you do next.
Thanks, man.
Because I do suspect that you will be, you will sort of... I see a similar thing that happened with James for you, if it's a path you want, which is like... The scale go, gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Be cool.
And
my heroes were growing up. My heroes were Sam Raimi and Peter Jackson. Those were guys who made fun horror, like crazy movies.
I love the Frighteners, by the way.
Oh my God, I love the Frighteners. I love the Frighteners.
That is such a fun
movie.
Weird movie.
Yeah.
That I think most people forget about, but it's a really, really great little ghost comedy.
Yeah, weird masterpiece. But those guys were my heroes, and they went on to make Lord of the Rings and Spider-Man and these huge movies, and I hope one day to make huge movies, but I'm kind of cool making this crazy. insane, violent, crazy superhero horror thing that I made right now.
If I were ever lucky enough to start directing horror movies, I don't think I would have. I don't have any. I don't want to make big movies.
You don't want to make big
movies? No, like I love what Rob Zombie's done, which is just like, I don't need to make movies any bigger than this.
Yeah.
And they're, it's like, I think it's just like a pressure thing. Like, I don't need a $200 million to make a thing. Like, I just... Yeah. If I kind of am able to do the thing that I want to do and that sustains itself, that sounds kind of fun to me. And I have a specific audience that's into that stuff, and I kind of just communicate directly with them. And then it's kind of out of the, it's sort of like the Adult Swim formula, which is like, well, we keep the, they kept the budgets below a certain amount because any bigger, then it's like a bunch of other people get involved.
Yes.
And they start giving notes and they start getting pressure. And it's like, if we keep it below this, then everyone.
Then no one can do whatever you want.
Do whatever you want. Yeah.
I love that. I mean, man, there's something so sexy about just that, but the sad reality is I fucking love visual effects and I like blowing shit up. I like shooting cannonballs through walls, and that's just the reality, Like the unfortunate thing is that my taste is just really visual, and visual costs money.
Yeah, God damn it!
I wish I could just do that. I wish I could just serve a small group of excited fans, or it doesn't have to be small, but like a corner of the market, and kind of not have to do the dance. But
I kind of weirdly like sci-fi and horror movies that have no effects in them because they have to be so creative.
Yes.
Like, Primer was a really interesting movie with that, where it's like, somehow they managed to build a time machine, like, in a cardboard box, basically, yeah, you know?
In a storage facility.
In a storage facility. And Time Crimes, which is Nacho Vigalondo, is another, like, God, there's no visual effects in that movie, and it's so mind-bendy. And
you're just picking all the time travel movies.
The time travel movies in particular. But
I love time travel.
Or the Duplass brothers. Yes. Like they make fucking movies on iPhones that are really cool. Where it's like, oh, you didn't, and that's where you realize like all the effects, all the bells and whistles are icing on the cake. But at the core, you just need a good story, and you need to be able to communicate that story well to people. And those are people that are yeah. you know.
I saw Guardians 2. I saw the first cut of Guardians 2. There was virtually no visual effects in it.
Oh, I remember. Was that screening?
That was the second.
That was the second time. Yeah.
But yeah, you saw it very early on.
There was like sort of like grayed out, like effects are going to go here.
Yes.
And remember, we were both, Lydia and I were both like, it works great. Like it works great. The effects were just an enhancement for the story.
It's just an enhancement. Yeah, yeah. The way I saw it was even less evolved than that. It was just people in front of green screens, right? and you watched the whole movie and went, yeah, that works.
How would your movie work as a play?
Like, I cried.
If your movie works as a play,
yeah,
then all the other stuff on top of it is extra, yeah, extra bonus.
Yeah, but I mean, it was literally you know, Chris and Rooker holding each other on a green screen, and there were tears coming out of my eyes, and I was like, wow, it plays like this, you know, and that really speaks to what story is and what's important in the story. And
that was the same kind of thing we were talking about with T2 before. Like, how do you take an antagonist from one movie and make him a protagonist? I love the value change of that. It's so much fun.
But don't you wonder, when you were saying that, I couldn't help but think, put myself in James Cameron's position, who cast a guy who, you know, was, you know, a kind of tough guy when he cast him in Terminator, but then became like a beloved household name and friendly faced movie star by the time he made Terminator 2. And I can't help but wonder if the world kind of teed up that brilliant choice
I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, because what an excellent use of Schwarzenegger in the first one. It's like, well, he sounds very robotic when he talks, and so it's like, well, we'll just kind of like the character is perfect for him.
He's a machine.
He's a machine. He's built like a machine. He talks like a machine. You know, so like he was able to utilize and maybe to that extent. Did the same thing where it's like, well, now these are his strengths.
Yeah.
And so I feel like
now he's done Twins and stuff like that.
Again,
he's not going to be the
good
scary
director
guy.
Is able to utilize the strengths of whatever is put in front of him. And then that was definitely, no, I didn't think about that. And I absolutely agree with you that had to do with
the world teeter.
Did you see the footage of the guy kicking Schwarzenegger in the back?
Oh my God.
Where it was just like, he just thought he got bumped.
I know.
Why would you do that to someone?
Why would you do that to someone? People are crazy about that stuff. They you know, I don't know why. That was the thing that fascinated me. I couldn't stop watching and thinking, why would you think that that's okay to do to someone?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. There are a lot of not great people in the world.
I guess.
I don't know. I don't know if it was the guy mentally ill, or was he just...
I don't know. I don't know anything,
I don't know anything about him either.
I saw a video and the guy's flying in and kicking someone he doesn't know in the back for no reason. Like, it just seemed like random aggression. But I do know that people look at people in Hollywood as if they're not like
not real.
Or if they're... Yeah.
Because I do think there is that element. Like, I do believe humans, and this is, you know... Unfortunately, what our social media culture is not fostering is that I do think people have evolved to need to be in front of each other to understand humanity. And when you just see people in two dimensions, you're not seeing them as real.
Right.
You're seeing this sort of machine expression of them.
Right.
And you're interacting with them through a machine.
Right.
And so it's very, there's a lot of, there is a tremendous amount of depersonalization that takes effect. And so, yeah, you're right. They just don't see them as real. I mean, I even remember when I used to do Chelsea Lately years ago, and you're kind of making fun of people in the news, and at a certain point you're like, I don't know. Like, I just started to feel bad. I'm like, wait, these are people.
Right.
But when you're making fun of me, you're like, yeah, whatever, they're not real. And it's like, no, they're real.
They're real. They're real. They're hearing that joke.
And yeah.
They're sitting in a dark room.
You're just taking cheap shots at humans who are just, yeah. you know, no, just ostensibly trying to do their best.
Yeah, they're just trying. Yeah, exactly.
You're like, yeah, fuck that guy. He's and it's like, you don't know. Like, you know, like we do.
That's interesting.
We are kind of losing our humanity, because I think we communicate with each other and we experience each other mostly in inhumane ways, which I think right. is why people are starting to feel so isolated with social media when it should feel so connecting. But also,
yes,
because we are falling down these trenches that of these hyper curated bubbles yeah. of our own little reality, it's like, that also is not helping either. Like, we need to get out and, you know, experience. Yeah. We need to experience.
Just talk to people.
We need to understand the human experience so we don't kick Schwarzenegger in the back.
Yeah.
Ultimately, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's true. And it's also like, I see what you're saying, though, right? Because, you know, when you see someone famous for the first time, you know, whoever it is, there's always a part, at least in my mind, where I'm like, oh, that's what they look like.
Yeah.
Oh, they're a person.
They're a person.
Oh, look at them. They do things.
Yeah.
Oh, they're normal.
Yeah, they're normal.
Yeah, but yeah, I know what you mean. There is kind of like that moment of translation where they go from a 2D image in on your screen or in a movie that you've seen into like just a person. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. Maybe there's something to play with that. Maybe the horror movie I should write is essentially some sort of an allegory for like fame devouring someone, ultimately becoming like a sentient entity and devouring, and you know, and like basically just devouring every piece of a person, you know, without them really understanding what's going on. Because you'd always hear, it's like, I feel like fame is sort of like the same thing as the metaphor is sort of the vampire thing, where it's like, how many vampire stories have you seen where someone's like, I really want to be a vampire, and they get turned into a vampire and they're like, what have I done? You know, because they sort of feel the soullessness of it. And it's
yes.
like, you don't know what you're wishing for until you, it's sort of like a warning for like, be careful what you wish for, you know?
Yes.
I almost sort of feel like, you know, being really famous is probably that way for some people, where they're like, oh wait, it's not at all what I thought it would be.
I don't want to be famous. Yeah. I've been around people who are famous. I don't want to be famous. I'm serious. I want to it's weird. I, as someone who's been around, you're famous.
Not really though. Like I have, like,
yeah,
cable,
yeah.
There's like a level of cable
right.
notoriety where it's like, which is very comfortable for me, which is the people who know who I am tend to be incredibly nice.
Right.
And you know, sometimes I'll get a nice table at a restaurant. Like, it's like
yeah,
that's the nice
yeah,
part.
Yeah, you get perks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, I got to go to Disneyland to see the Star Wars thing a little bit early. That's fun, you know? Like,
yeah.
I don't have to deal with, you know, like, where
people
get in car wrecks because they're being chased by, like, that does not sound.
Yeah, that's
like, the public owns you and your property and you fucking, you know.
Scary.
Yeah, that part. And what that must do to people's brains to.
Yeah, and the walls you must put up.
Of course, to protect
yourself
yeah.
and to protect yourself from it's weird. I don't think I want it for myself. If I can avoid it, I will.
Something to think about as you make your when you make your $200 million big budget movie.
Yeah, but there's plenty of directors whose names you could hear that you couldn't like imagine what they look like.
Right.
You know, you don't know what they look like, and I'm okay with being that guy.
Well, I'm so happy for you. And
thank
congratulations.
You.
And and then, you know, I'm excited to have you come back to talk about the next thing that you make, which will probably
take
a little while longer.
You know, I do feel like the little present I have at the end of every movie is to come do this podcast.
Oh, come on.
No, I really do enjoy this podcast. One of my highlights of The Hive was coming and doing the podcast.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, well, so I think we did that at Meltdown, so it was even more like we're in a comic book store.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing a thing.
Yeah, so it's really cool. So I look forward to what room we'll be in.
It's almost Meltdown. I saved that for Meltdown.
Oh, my God, you did. I was looking at that thing going, where have I seen
it? Yeah, yeah, it was on the roof of Meltdown.
Oh, my God.
I had all of the neon restored.
Wow.
So I just don't keep it on during the podcast because
it
of
buzzes.
That buzz.
Yeah. But it looks cool.
Yeah, it's loud as fuck. Couldn't hear that from Sunset Boulevard.
No.
When that was up on the roof of Meltdown.
Neon's loud. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I know. All right. This because I've...
Do you have your own neon?
No, but if we did some shoots with neon. It was like, what is that sound?
Someone needs to invent a quieter neon. Come on, science. Get on that shit. All right. That's it. Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Thank you. Great to see you.
The end!
Welcome to Word Salad Wrap for episode number 1004 with Dave Yarveski. Yarvo. Go see Brightburn. That's my last thing before I get into the Word Salad Wrap, which, oh, okay, no, there's another last thing before I get into the Word Salad Wrap. As I said, I'm in Nashville, and I just have to thank anyone who is coming out to the stand-up shows, because I'll sign stuff after the shows and stuff, and it never fails to amaze me how friggin' nice the people are that come out to the shows or who listen to the podcast or who watch The Walking Dead or who watch The Wall or whatever it is. I just want to say you're nice, and I really appreciate that. And just so you know, venues almost all the time will comment on, oh, the people that come out to your shows are like really nice. So I really appreciate that. That to have assembled a nice group of people is a tremendous accomplishment, in my opinion, and I really appreciate it. So I want to thank you for being you and for being nice and coming out to these shows. Nashville's a really, as I said, I love the town, but since I was here the last time, they've implemented this thing called pedal taverns, where people like group bicycle while they're drinking. You may have seen them. I feel like maybe they're in Vegas. I don't know. They're not everywhere, but it's like a table on wheels, and then everyone has pedals, and they're drinking and pedaling. Because you know what drinking needs? Physical exercise. Yeah. Doing some cardio shots. It's just like saying, like, yeah, I want to drink a keg of beer, but I got to get my steps in. I got to get them in. So that is, that's, and also they super clog traffic too. So when you're waiting to go somewhere and you see a bunch of people hooting and hollering cause they're getting tanked in traffic, it's a thing, I gotta tell you. But now onto, more positive things, which is I can finally talk about, for anyone, and this is, if you don't really care about Disneyland, again, this might be the time to bail out if you haven't already, but, my old buddy Will Wheaton and I, a week ago, got to see a sneak preview of Galaxy's Edge, the new... I mean, we'll just call it Star Wars Land, because it's basically what it is. Even though they're not calling it Star Wars Land, it's Star Wars Land. It's the first expansion of the park in who knows how long, but they created a bunch more space by stealing some backstage space. And, I don't want to spoil too much about it, but I'll give you some highlights. It's incredible. It's completely immersive. You forget you're in Disneyland when you're there. They've done a really great job of like forced perspective mountains and stuff. It really just feels like you're in a space out. It feels like you're in an outpost. And there's of course a lot of shops, which I don't mind because we bought a bunch of stuff, but there's a place where you can assemble your own droids and give them their own little personalities. You can buy Jedi stuff, Sith stuff. You can buy pretty much anything your heart desires that's Star Wars related. And also, if you want to drop $25,000, you can get a customized R2 droid, which, oh, it's so it's tempting to like, can I scrape that together to get this thing? And you're like, okay, well, wait a minute, maybe I'm getting a little too crazy. But apparently people are buying those. So there's little stations where you can get blue milk and green milk, which I think are sort of akin to the butter beer that you get at Universal, but it's just kind of like a sugary, slushy drink. And then there is a cantina, like a full cantina inside. Will and I couldn't go to that because the line was so incredibly long. There are ultimately going to be two rides in Galaxy's Edge. One of them is not open yet, and I think probably doesn't open until the fall. But the one that we did get to go do was the Smuggler's Run. So you do pilot the Millennium Falcon, and you go in with people go in groups of six. Everyone has a job. Mine was to steer left and right. Will's was to steer up and down. And then there are like engineers, and there are people. There's like weapons, and so it's super fun. And I do get kind of motion sick in in like motiony types of sim rides, but it was worth it because it's a blast. And so, you know, I recommend it. I'm sure wait times are going to be the thing to deal with, but you know, it is, especially when the second ride opens in the fall, which the rumor I heard is that the budget for the second ride is like four times more than even the Smuggler's Run one. So I'm sure that will be pretty spectacular as well. There's a full-size Millennium Falcon. There's full-size X-Wing, Land Speeders, TIE Fighters. I mean, it's... Oh, and I think the best part is... This really was probably one of my favorite parts. The cast members really go out of their way to interact with people as they're walking through to make it fully immersive. And so you will see like rebels running around, hiding, ducking behind things. And then, you know, like a whole First Order troop will walk by. And Will and I bought plushy Porg puppets because why wouldn't we? And there were cast members would come up in, you know, in the standard kind of like, I work in a space outpost gear, and be like, what are you doing with that? Surely you're going to eat that. Why are you carrying that around? And they were berating the porks. So it's really fun. It's fully immersive. And I was so thankful to go and lucky that we got to see it early. So I'm just passing on the experience to you. I'm going to post a bunch of pictures about it. Will and I went... it was just a boy's day. My poor wife was had an infection after we came back, for like a throat infection and a sinus infection after we came back from Europe. And just so you know, I did offer not to go because she was sick. And Liz was like, no, you are absolutely going. You have to go, please. I'm just going to sleep all day and I will feel better if you go. And I said, well, okay, if it'll make you happy. But of course I was secretly thrilled that she was so cool about me going because it's Galaxy's Edge. And so I'm going to take her later in the summer. But, what an incredible day to spend with one of my oldest and dearest friends who we had been going to Disneyland since like 1991, I think. When we were just, bratty teenagers, we got our annual passes and would go every night. Back when Disneyland was a little less crowded. You just go every night at like, you get that residence, Southern California residence pass. You show up at like 10 o'clock at night. You got 2 hours before the park closed. And back then, it would kind of empty out between 10 and midnight. So we could just ride stuff multiple times. And so, yeah, so I'm gonna post some pictures. But it's really great to have friends for so long and that we're still doing the same silly shit that we were doing when we were bratty teenagers. So thanks for listening to Word Salad Wrap. I hope if you are a Star Wars fan or a Disneyland fan and you're excited about Galaxy's Edge that this was enlightening for you. So thanks so much, and I appreciate you, and I will see you in your ears very soon. I'd start to sing Star Wars music, but I'm like, wait, is that copywritten? Am I allowed to do that? Maybe I should not do this right now. Maybe that's not legal. Can't get that low. I gotta go get raspier.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.